Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde here in a special, extra special New Year's Eve, almost New Year's Eve, I should say, episode where we are going to be making predictions about the future, something that this podcast never does. Erica C. Barnett of Publicola, why did you agree to do that? It goes against every core of your podcast being.
Well,
to make predictions.
Mostly because we planned in advance for once, and it wasn't you springing some bullshit on me about giving somebody a letter grade.
Just wait. All right, and Sandeep Kashuk also here. All right, and so today, with great enthusiasm, we head into 2024 with confident predictions, and some from folks who listen to this podcast. And Sandeep, tell us about it. Let's start with you because you've got somebody writing in or speaking to you about a prediction.
Yeah, I got a prediction from a listener who basically said that his prediction, as if I understand it correctly, is that in November of 2024, the Teresa Mosqueda citywide open seat for the city council is going to be won by a left lane candidate, which I thought was an interesting prediction, given the last election we just had.
That's incredibly juicy.
Yeah, did he tell you any more about why he thought that, given the outcome of the most recent
election? Yeah,
he
provided two reasons for his prediction, one being the vastly increased turnout of the 2024 November election, right? We're in a presidential year, and we're going to have kind of almost 80% turnout, so that's kind of interesting. And the other one being the effort to repeal the Climate Commitment Act, as well as a number of other conservative ballot measures that look right now like they're going to qualify for the ballot this year, is going to drive progressive turnout.
All right, I like that prediction.
Yeah, I think there may be something to it.
I don't know if I agree with it, but I like it.
I don't know whether I agree with it either. I will say this. I was talking with someone today, and this is not – please, to our listeners, don't take this as like set in stone or gospel because I was not able to confirm it. But a potential candidate for that election this coming November for the open council seat told me that she was hearing that Seattle Elections is saying they're not going to have a primary – so it will just be an election in November. So that could have interesting implications if you have multiple people running. Let's say you have five candidates running. I guess they'll all be on the same ballot in November. And they are going to do democracy vouchers for this election. But apparently the word was that they would not do $100 a person in democracy vouchers, but $50 a person. So I think that will also raise some questions with candidates about whether they want to go the voucher route at all. Because you're still going to have to get, I believe for a citywide race, $410 contributions to even get over the threshold to qualify to kind of get the voucher money, which is a lot, right? And if you can only get $50 a pop, is it worth it? Is it not worth it? I mean, I think those are interesting questions about the structure of this election that could have some significant impacts, right, on how it turns out.
Is it Wayne Barnett that makes that decision? Who makes that decision?
I guess so. I guess it's in the purview of Seattle Ethics and Elections, which would be Wayne Barnett. I haven't really dug into it, but I think it's kind of odd that if they forego a primary, I think that's kind of odd, right? The other thing I don't know is, are they going to use the ranked choice voting system that voters passed recently in Seattle? Is that going to be implemented for this, single general election cattle call ballot, right? Because that could have implications too.
Is this the dream of even year elections finally coming to Seattle politics?
I think that's, our predictor. I think that is probably his dream. Yeah. We will see. As you both know, I have made the counterintuitive the counter establishment narrative argument that I don't think higher turnout in Seattle necessarily favors the left anymore.
All right. So we've heard from Sandeep. That's a pretty juicy one. Erica, I understand that you are going to be making predictions of your own. I can't wait. So let's hear it. What is going to happen? 2024, Erica C. Barnett.
Yeah, so I've got a few predictions, you know, and none of them are really about elections, but one is about the consequences of elections. Actually, a couple are. My first is that the city council with a new, more conservative majority is going to roll back some of the renter protections that were passed, you know, largely at the behest of or supported by or pushed by socialist councilmember Shama Sawant. Say what you will about Sawant, but there were a lot of renter protections that happened in her committee while she was there. There's a $10 maximum late fee, for example. There's relocation requirements. The city has to pay relocation for low-income tenants who are forced to move by rent increases of more than 10%. There's winter and school year eviction moratorium. So there's a lot of new laws that went into effect over the last term. And I think that the city council that's coming in may be interested in overturning some of those laws. So, I mean, we'll see. They're going to have, you know, as we've discussed a bunch of times, a really steep learning curve. You know, will these be their priorities? I don't know. But there is definitely a very vocal landlord constituency sort of advocating for the so-called mom and pop landlords that we've been covering quite a bit at Publicola recently, you know, that say that all these renter protections are making it, you know, impossible for them to operate and driving them out of the city. So I think they're going to have, you know, very sympathetic ears on the council. So I can easily see, you know, at least some of those protections, particularly the first in time ordinance, which requires landlords to, once they start accepting applications, to rent to the first qualified applicant. That's gotten a lot of complaints from landlords. So I could see that getting rolled back if somebody on the new council decides to take that on.
And that was a, if I remember correctly, that was a Lisa Herbold sponsored protection. Yes. Back when it passed. This is a kind of, it was early on in the spate of, as you say, there's been a shit ton of renter protection legislation that sort of come through and the council has passed. And I guess I'm going to go on the record and say I wouldn't mind seeing that one get repealed. I think that, while well-intended, I think I do think that protection in particular has had an unintended negative consequence, in that I know a lot of management agencies that manage rental properties have jacked up their application criteria so that, you know, basically anybody who's got sort of iffy credit or, you know, a less than perfect record, you know, wouldn't be able to meet the criteria, and they could bypass them, right? Because they have to accept the first person that meets the criteria they set out. So it's led to, you know, it's led to at least some restriction, right, on those with less than perfect records being able to rent.
I mean, I think that have to be proved by more than just anecdote. I mean, there's a new report that just came out that I reported on this week from the city that, you know, that basically said, I mean, landlords will complain, you know, a lot about all these restrictions, but the main reason it appears landlords are getting out of the market, and we're talking about small landlords with 20 units or less, you know, largely like landlords that have one single family house, is because they're selling it and making money, because it's been a good time to sell houses and small buildings in Seattle. So, I mean, there is a lot of complaint about the first-in-time ordinance, and I can see intuitively, Sandeep, I see why as well, you know, but if the response to this is like, well, landlords need to be able to rent to who they want to, that is exactly the reason, you know, that response is exactly the reason this ordinance passed, because, you know, that leads to racial and class discrimination. I mean, all like there are very good reasons that Lisa Herbold and other council members supported this ordinance. And it's because, you know, if you give landlords total discretion, often they misbehave. And interestingly, in this study from the city, one of the things that the city discovered was that small landlords overwhelmingly, I mean, by just huge margins, have the most complaints from tenants about housing violations, building code violations, and landlord-tenant law violations. So I'm a little reluctant to just simply take them at their anecdotal word. I would need a lot more evidence that this is really happening to say, you know, that they should roll this law back, but I think they might.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you. It was well-intentioned, and it was obviously clearly intended to address some of the problems that you're raising with either, you know, implicit or unintentional, or for that matter, intentional bias, right? And you know, who gets apartments, particularly in a hot market where multiple people are applying for it. So I get that there's a problem there. I'm not sure that this has been the right solution.
here's my prediction, my bold prediction for 2024. Not much changes when it comes to the city of Seattle. It's kind of still the Harrell administration, and we're not going to swing or lurch too far to the right as some people might fear. It's just going to kind of limp along. There's going to be some changes that people don't like. It sounds like with renter protections being rolled back and some other things, but by and large, the city of Seattle is going to move forward in a similar direction to the direction that it's followed like for quite a while. And I'll make an even bolder prediction than that. No one's going to pay any attention to Seattle city politics whatsoever for the next year, because the presidential race is going to eat up all of the interest. So let's hope this podcast survives. That's all I can say. With your support.
I find that perennial prediction kind of silly. I mean, people who pay attention to local politics are, by and large, not going to be distracted by the shiny object of the presidential election to the extent that they can't pay attention to both. I'd say most people don't pay attention to local politics, to my chagrin. But I think that people who do are going to be engaged. And I don't think that, who the president is going to occupy everybody's total
wishful
attention.
Thinking right. For this podcast is all
well,
I can say. Let's
look,
hope they
I mean,
do.
It's always the do. Case. It's always the case, as I said. Like I lament this all the time, that people pay attention to stuff they can't really influence or do anything about. You know, the more national, the more international, the more concerned people are, and the more interested
totally.
People are. But local is what matters, and the people who know that, and they're maybe 5% of the population, unfortunately.
Thanks for listening. Please. Yeah. Please donate to Seattle Nice and Patreon.
I'm going to offer a friendly – I mean, I'll make 2 points about David's prediction. One, I do think the argument David is making there is why it would be a bad idea to – I think the main reason why it would be a bad idea to shift our municipal elections to even years, I do think they will get drowned out and will not get nearly the amount of kind of media and public oxygen that they get now, whether it's a mayor's race or council races in years when you've got congressional and legislative and presidential races on the ballot, right? So it seems to me like we're kind of headed in that direction of switching everything to even years, or at least there's some momentum behind that. The other thing I will add is just a friendly addendum to David's prediction, which is that 1 year from now, the three of us are going to be boring to tears, our Seattle Nice audience, with the same stale takes on homelessness, crime, and addiction. We'll be talking about the same stuff at the end of the year that we've been talking about for the last year.
You mean things won't get solved?
Well, that seems to be what you're saying, and I think that's probably right. That's probably the safest prediction to be made. Yeah. I'm going to counter your prediction, though, with one that cuts against the grain of it. Which is, this is my kind of, going way out on a limb, sort of taking a big flyer kind of prediction. And I'm going to suggest that by the end of this year, we will actually see put forward in some shape or form, potentially as a ballot measure or, potentially as something that would be happen council manically, but an actual real plan to address the fentanyl crisis that is happening on our streets, a plan that would actually have things.
Wow,
like,
that's a big swing.
Yeah, I'm going out on a limb.
The council that has never gotten it done, and the mayor who's never
gotten
it done.
Like that's why I'm holding out the possibility that there may be an opportunity to go to the ballot with something if you can't get the politicians to do something. First of all, I think the problem on our streets that's being created by fentanyl, the toll in lives that it's taking, is just enormous and cries out for a more serious and sustained response. And then secondly, the harm that particularly virulent form of addiction is causing, not just in lost lives, but in, downstream crime and disorder and all the kind of stuff we're seeing on the streets also ought to be addressed, right? And so there's a vacuum right now. We will see. I'm gonna go out on a limb. I've heard some preliminary sort of, nascent conversations about trying to pull together something that could be a real plan. We'll see whether those go anywhere. So I'm gonna, but that's one of my outlier predictions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason I'm extremely pessimistic about that idea is that the council that is coming on board and, you know, the council president and the mayor do not, frankly, seem to have a grasp on what a real plan, as you put it, would look like. And probably you and I, you know, might not agree on what a real plan is. But, I mean, the proposals that I've heard so far are like, let's put a teensy little bit of money into evidence-based solutions. And not even necessarily do them the right way. You know, I'm not sure that place-based opiate response sites or one site is going to be, you know, the panacea that people think it is. We're doing that. I mean, it's better than a lot of the other stuff we're doing, but, you know, it's too little. It's obviously late, and I'm not sure it's the right place to put our investments. But like the rest of it is mostly punitive approaches. It's saying, you know, let's put people in traditional treatment that fails all the time and, you know, from which people emerge and often overdose. Let's put people in jail where they can, you know, supposedly dry out or, you know, or clean up and think about what they've done and get sober that way. There's just, there's a lot of ideas out there that are not serious ideas, but I'm afraid that if we go the route you're talking about and put something on the ballot, it's going to be for like very expensive capital projects and in place-based solutions, plus a lot of punishment and stuff that doesn't work, like standard issue treatment. So I haven't seen any reason for optimism that everybody who has said they support things other than evidence-based solutions are going to suddenly support evidence-based stuff. But, you know, maybe you know more than I do. I don't know.
I think this is a challenge.
I'm not optimistic.
The challenge of doing something, I think anything real in my mind would involve both, you know, what we might call carrot and stick, right? I don't think
evidence in terms of carrots and sticks, you're already off on the wrong foot.
Yeah, I don't.
You have to do what works.
Right.
And you have to follow the science where it goes and not think of it as punishment and reward.
I gotta stop for one second and ask about this because it's become a sort of rhetorical, what's the right word for it? Trope. It's this use of the phrase that Eric is using right now, evidence-based. And Sandeep, there's no response from you to that whatsoever. You're just kind of changing the subject and sort of ignoring it. So what about that? Your proposals are not evidence-based. Stand up for yourself, Sandeep Kaushik.
I'm happy to address
that. Or just agree that you're not interested in evidence-based solutions.
With the term coming from Erica and folks on the left, when they say evidence-based, what they're saying is they're pointing to a series of studies about what is in this formulation for the addicts themselves. But these studies don't take into account the social consequences or the downstream consequences of addiction or crime, right? They're not a kind of comprehensive look at sort of what the reality of addiction is and all of its facets and what it does, right? And what I'm saying is, yeah, there are, we've argued about this before. We don't need to keep arguing about it here as we're doing predictions, but that there are times when it may not be the absolute best thing in the world for the addict to go to jail, but it might be better overall for society if the addict goes to jail for a while. And right. And the sort of quote unquote evidence-based kind of attack on that ignores the kind of downstream social consequences of addiction.
So you're conceding, though, that the evidence.
I'm not necessarily conceding. No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is that there's definitely, we can get into the nitty gritty of like kind of what kind of treatment.
Well, if you don't mind,
works,
I could explain what I mean by evidence based. Nobody's asked me, but I'm happy to explain.
No. That was the next thing that was coming.
Okay. Sorry. Well, for example, you know, one thing the evidence does show, not just in America, but around the world, is that punitive approaches towards addiction, and particularly, you know, opiate addiction, alcohol addiction as well, do not work. And what does work, and particularly with opiate addiction, is quote unquote meeting people where they're at, which is another trope, I realize, but, you know, accepting the fact that people are not going to just go cold turkey, quit on their own, you know, or quit in jail or quit in treatment and become, you know, new shiny people after they come out of the treatment car wash. In fact, a lot of times it takes a very long time to get somebody on the road to recovery, which, you know, we can say, let's say that's sobriety. We want most people to get sober. In the meantime, it's really important to, you know, A, keep them alive, and B, improve their quality of life. And so that means doing things like providing clean needles, like, you know, I would argue providing safe drugs. And when I say safe, what I mean is drugs that are not adulterated with substances that will cause someone to die. Doing opiates, being addicted, is not safe, but safer supply is an incredibly important part of, you know, harm reduction. And also providing social services, regardless of whether somebody becomes clean instantaneously or not, you know, not doing the so-called stick of, like, I don't know, kicking people out of shelters, which we do, or kicking people out of housing, which we do. And that in turn actually does address, or begins to address, all of the things that Sandeep is saying that we should be throwing people in jail for, because they have, you know, societal consequences to people who are, you know, in living in cities with drug users who are homeless, who are causing disorder on the streets. I mean, this is not like, I mean, maybe it's a radical concept for the United States, but there are lots of, you know, Lisa Dugard, who we've, you know, talked to and talked about quite a bit before, with Purpose Dignity Action, has been advocating for these kind of things for a very long time, and she is no radical leftist. So I think saying that scientific evidence has a leftist bias is really kind of not seeing the forest for the trees, because, you know, addressing some of these problems and not requiring people to become perfect overnight, like, actually would help a lot of the stuff that Sandeep, that you're concerned about, and that, you know, that I'm concerned about as well. I mean, I don't like, you know, having to see people homeless and suffering and, you know, passed out on the street and overdosing.
I don't want to keep arguing about this, because I feel like we're getting far afield from predictions and we're going back to an old argument.
So I have another prediction.
Yes, another prediction. Go.
All right. So I actually have a couple more, but the third one is a kind of a grab bag. So I'll just say, going back to the city council, you know, you were talking, David, about there's not going to be a lurch to the right, but I think there is going to be a lurch towards austerity in the city budget, just because, by virtue of the fact that we have a city council that says they don't think that the city has a budget problem, they have a spending problem. And the budget problem, I mean, as it, you know, it has been laid out by staffers at the city for many months, is that they're facing a $200+ million deficit over the next couple years each year.
I don't disagree with that. I support that prediction. I've said major.
So let me finish my prediction. So I think that,
but you misquoted me to start, so I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, fair, fine.
Okay.
So I think that it's not going to be a lurch to the right, but it is going to be a lurch toward austerity. And how that's going to play out is, you know, in the form of budget cuts, obviously. But also, I think that, you know, there's the raid on Jumpstart that happens every year. That's the payroll expense tax on big employers, I think is going to really accelerate this year. And I think that the original purpose under statute for which Jumpstart was intended will become, you know, potentially kind of meaningless and be abandoned. This is, you know, a pessimistic prediction, but I think I could see it happening. I also think it's going to be really hard or really unlikely for this council to pass a capital gains tax that actually increases the city's revenue. City didn't do it this year because they're waiting to see what happens at the state level with the state capital gains tax. But if that's upheld, it's hard for me to see the city opting to pass a real, you know, net increase in capital gains. The proposal that Alex Peterson made was essentially to offset the water tax, which is a regressive tax that you pay for utilities, with a new capital gains tax, which is great, except that $200, $250 million hole is still looming out there. So, I'm not optimistic about progressive revenue, and I'm very pessimistic about the budget. So I think that adds up to austerity.
I personally would like to see a municipal capital gains tax, if there is one, used to fund something important like a fentanyl plan, right? That it's actually meaningful. But leaving that aside, I did see a tweet the other day from the I-135 people, right? These are the social housing folks that passed their unfunded social housing ballot measure a year ago, saying that in January they're going to come forward with a plan, which it looks like they intend to take to the ballot to fund their measure, to create a funding stream for their measure. I don't know what taxing mechanism they intend to use in that, but it looks like they intend to go to the ballot in 24 on that. And so I guess I would kind of go semi out on a limb, because it's been a long time since we've seen something like this happen. But I think they may have some pretty rough sledding on the ballot if they put a tax measure forward. And I say that because I still don't see or have seen any evidence that they have a plan that's even remotely cooked about financing housing, you know, and how they're going to do it. And so it was one thing to pass this sort of feel-good measure that didn't cost anything. It's quite another if you don't have a cooked plan to come forward and say, now give us a huge pile of money and an ongoing endless revenue stream. And I think that's a different conversation. So skeptical that at least I haven't seen it yet. And I've said before, I would love for them to prove me wrong. If they can create a new model for doing kind of mixed-use housing that's semi or fully self-sustaining and works along this sort of social housing model, I'm all for it. I'm not at all opposed to the idea of new kind of housing models. I just haven't seen any evidence yet that they can deliver on that. So, and I'm not sure that they really, again, have a plan. I think they spent way more time on the sort of minutiae of the intersectional composition of their governing board and lived experience and that kind of stuff than they have on actually figuring out how to build and pay for housing. So we'll see. But if I can make a prediction, Erica, I'm curious what you think of on this. This is sort of low-hanging fruit in some ways. I'm not sure it's actually going to come to pass, but at least within a year. But we seem headed in that direction, which is that I think the King County Regional Homelessness Authority is dead by the end of the year.
Do you really? That's interesting. So I stayed away from that one to some extent because I was thinking, God, do I make a bold prediction? But maybe Sandeep will make it. That's really interesting. Why do you think it's going to be dead within a year?
Well, first of all, okay,
to just kind of going on and it's kind of moribund, you know, pass through agency state.
Which is probably the more likely scenario, right? But look, I think we both agree that King County RHA has had a series of really deep-seated problems, right? I mean, you can talk about the really nominal, at best, sort of regional buy-in to the Regional Homelessness Authority, the fact that it's almost entirely funded by King County and the City of Seattle. And again, it doesn't have its own independent funding source, so it's completely dependent on those two entities for its funding, and therefore those entities, those governments feel like they ought to have control over their own dollars. The governance structure is unwieldy and frankly idiotic and terrible, you know, and they've been without a CEO since Mark Doan's resigned the position. How many months has it been? And
I think it was in August.
September? Yeah, it's been and I hear, you know, and so a huge amount rides on this search that's supposedly underway for the new CEO. And what I have heard is that this search, like they're talking about a timeline of onboarding a new CEO, like well into the second half of 2024 before, so that means we're going to have a kind of semi-rudderless organization beset with all these problems for a year, right? You know, before there's a new CEO who's, if someone coming in from the outside, we'll have a 6 months to a year learning curve to kind of get up to speed, you know, so it doesn't look... The future here does not look that promising.
And I'll add to that. I mean, there have been, and I'm going to be writing about this soon, but there's just been a tremendous amount of turnover. The chief of staff, Ann Berkland, I believe just left. And there's just a tremendous amount of sort of churn over there that does not, I mean, it doesn't bode well, but it also doesn't make for a well-functioning agency. So, you know, I can see, I think your prediction might be a little far-fetched in the year timeframe, but I mean, I think there are just fundamental problems way beyond the governance structure. Just as you said, the way it's set up, the fact that, you know, the funding sources are kind of like, you know, King County puts it's the same money it was spending already into the bucket, and the City of Seattle does the same. And, you know, I think that I can see the city sort of using a lack of progress as an excuse for providing less funding to the agency, which is just kind of a death spiral.
Who would take the leadership role in it dissolving? Like who's going to step into the breach, Sandeep or Erica, and make that happen?
Yeah, well, either Bruce Harrell or Adele Constantine, the King County executive, could by simply, you know, declining to fund, through the county council and, with the city council or county council's concurrence, declining to fund the agency. That would necessitate a whole lot of things, including laying off, the staff, all or most of the staff. So, I mean, you can shut down the agency if you pull their budget, because they're entirely dependent on the city and county.
No, my question was, who would do that?
Yeah, I mean, what you're asking me is even if there's a kind
of... That seems really unlikely to me.
Right. But David, what you're saying is even if there's an internal assessment that this experiment has been a kind of failure, do they have the political will to kind of,
The leadership.
To say so publicly. And I don't know.
And what are we going to do instead?
Are we going to just keep going along?
I'm just
going
to say...
Well, we can go back to the model we had a few years ago, which is that, the city and county, fund a bunch of stuff directly with their funding, right? As opposed to going through this, handing their dollars over to this regional entity, which then ostensibly is spending it better. Only, all their big initiatives, right? The big high profile, we're going to clear downtown of homelessness. All that stuff has gone kind of belly up. The CEO, the founding CEO is gone. We're months and months and months away from having a new CEO, and it's not at all clear who is going to want that job, given all the problems. So, I don't know.
I've heard a lot of people say that, who are, in the know, that the King County Homelessness Authority is can't fail, that, we can't go back to that system because it was not a good system, where the city of Seattle and King County were sort of atomized. And frankly, I don't think the Human Services Department and the city really wants to deal with homelessness. Now, that doesn't mean that it, that it actually can't fail, but there's a lot of, sort of goodwill and if it's no longer goodwill, just kind of momentum invested in making the KCRHA work. That said, I can, imagine, I'm not predicting this, but I can't imagine a scenario where, where Harold just says, we're done. He's never been enthusiastic about, putting more money into the KCRHA, or investing in some of the initiatives that Mark Doan's proposed when they were there. So I can actually see that scenario. I mean, we do try things and they fail sometimes. If I can change topics slightly, to the topic of another CEO situation, Sound Transit just lost its CEO, Julie Tim, reportedly asked to leave by the board and got a really bad evaluation. And so she's out of there as of basically now. And I think they're going to have a really tough time finding a new CEO. And I don't think a new CEO is going to be a panacea. I think Sound Transit is going to continue to struggle if it doesn't figure out how to turn into a massive capital building agency and an operations agency, which was kind of Julie Tim's strength at the same time. And they haven't been able to, they haven't demonstrated that they can do that yet. And I think it's going to be a really, really big challenge to find a new CEO and then find, other people, because they're hiring for other positions, to actually build out all this stuff that they're, this massive, massive mega project that they're building. I mean, they need some mega project experts and they need a really high quality CEO. And, frankly, last time they looked for a CEO, about 2 years ago, they didn't get, a lot of super qualified candidates. And I don't see why that'd be any different now.
Well, I will say it is a
And really, when I say super qualified, I mean for those particular, skill sets. I'm not saying Julie Tim wasn't qualified in some ways, but I think that
it's a really,
she struggled on this.
It's a really big job that requires, in fact, more than one fairly esoteric skill set, right? Because not only, to your point, part of the frustration about Sound Transit is it's taking so fucking long for them to build anything, right? And so we pass a Sound Transit ballot measure in 2016 that I was involved in getting that passed back in 2016. And now they're saying we're not going to get to fucking Ballard till 2041, it's going to take us 25 years to get to Ballard, right? And so I do think that there needs to be, or there's a lot of talk right now that there needs to be somebody who has sort of construction mega project transportation experience. But the other thing you need is political savvy, right? You've got to manage a board, an appointed board of, I think it's 18 regional politicians. you know, who all have their own agendas and their own sort of parochial concerns, and you as CEO have to kind of, you know, negotiate that minefield and balance those interests. So it's asking a lot to have somebody with all this sort of detailed construction management experience who's also like a stellar politician. I've heard a lot of chatter about that job, right? And I do think there's quite a bit of interest in it. I think unlike the King County RHA job, which I think feels to a lot of people like it may not be the most secure career move, I think there are a lot of people that see Sound Transit, while it has some problems, as a fundamentally like rooted, established, important agency. And so I've heard a number of names, which I'm not going to air out here, of people that might be interested in that position. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how that whole thing plays out.
Yeah, well, they also need to rein in some of their board members from changing things all the time. And I'm not talking about the suburban board members that you know, kind of fundamentally aren't really into transit. I'm talking about our board members here in Seattle who want to, you know, constantly be changing station plans at the last minute. I mean, that's a huge reason that everything is always so slow, is that we make decisions and then we revisit them, you know, ad infinitum while the costs add up. And there's got to be a point where you know, where someone says no to that processy stuff, because it just drags everything out forever.
Yeah. Hey, I have a great idea to get to Ballard. Why don't we do a 9-year planning process? You know, which is really what they build into the, I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm totally with you on that. But it seems to be part of the DNA of how we do politics in, you know, Western Washington. And so it's going to be hard to change that. But I think it would be a breath of fresh air to see someone come in and actually, you know, get some shit done.
That's a great place to end. Thanks so much for listening to another edition of Seattle Nice. He's Sandeep Kaushik. She's Erica C. Barnett. I'm David Hyde. And if you want to contribute and keep this important podcast coming your way, go to Patreon/Seattle Nice. You can also review us wherever you get your podcasts. Some of the reviews are a little, you know, critical. That's not what reviews are for. You're meant to just tell us how great we are, and that's all we really want. So please consider doing that, and thanks everybody so much for listening.